You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of October 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Andrew Muller. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, in Russia, the very few voters who can be bothered turn out in regional elections. You'll never guess whose party wins. Our Moscow correspondent will be live in the studio to discuss the implications. Japanese mobile operator SoftBank shells out $21.1 billion for US carrier Sprint. It's the most a Japanese firm has ever spent on an overseas acquisition. We'll ask what SoftBank are getting for their money. Istanbul becomes the latest of the barely countable cities around the world to stage some sort of design beano. We'll ask the co-curator of the Istanbul Biennial what's different about his.
The ambition of this exhibition was to actually encourage Istanbul to reevaluate itself, to also value this knowledge about how to make things is actually one of the greatest wealths of this society.
And as Monocle 24 prepares to celebrate its first year on air, a panel of Monocle senior staff recall some of their favourite moments so far.
Almost 1 year ago to the day, we were all sat round this table here in Studio One at 6 a.m. ready to do the very first Globalist.
All that plus a check-in with our New York bureau chief and music too, all coming up in the next hour here on Midori House. But before all that, a check of the world headlines with Bill Bingham.
Monocle 24 News. The former captain of the capsized cruise ship Costa Concordia has appeared in court at a pre-trial hearing into January's disaster. Legal teams and experts have begun to try to reconstruct the accident in a series of pre-trial hearings attended by Francesco Schettino. The court will decide if he should face a full trial, which could take place next year. Captain Friedrich van Wijnen, the General Secretary of European Shipmasters Associations, says the concentration on the bridge on the night of the capsizing was wrong.
The officers on the bridge were not very experienced. When Captain Schettino took over, it took some time to get accustomed to the light because he just came on the bridge. And then, of course, he was called by the company and he had to answer the call. And he was distracted for it. This was happening. And that he admits also to me that that was a mistake.
Israel has welcomed the news that European Union governments have agreed further sanctions against Iran's banking, shipping and industrial sectors. The moves are designed to increase financial pressure on Tehran to enter serious negotiations on its nuclear program. EU foreign ministers are concerned Israel may attack Iranian atomic installations if a combination of sanctions and diplomacy doesn't produce a peaceful solution. Israel's Vice Prime Minister Silvan Shalom says the new sanctions are very important.
It shows us that they can impose tougher sanctions that were imposed until recently. Sanctions works. If they will be tougher enough, finally they might bring the Iranians to think, maybe to abandon their dream to develop a nuclear program. And in order to do so, we need to continue to impose more sanctions on Iran in order to bring them to change their attitude. And the sooner, the better.
The number of Syrian refugees housed in camps in southern Turkey has gone into six figures. The Turkish Disaster Management Agency, AFAD, says it's a level beyond which Ankara had previously said it could accommodate. AFAD's president, Ayda Kaya, says they'll do their best to look after them.
As of today, we do have indeed more than 100,000 refugees in Turkey. Indeed, we call them as our guests, indeed, because we treat them as our guests. So we do have almost 13 camps running, up and running, as of today again. And we do have other camps under construction. We are trying our best indeed to get ready for those who are in need.
Air Armenia are denying that Turkey forced their aeroplane to land in the eastern Turkish city of Erzurum. The airline's director, Arsen Avet Isyan, explained it was a scheduled landing on the route from the Armenia capital Yerevan to Aleppo in Syria. Turkey gave the flight an all-clear and allowed the Armenian plane, which was carrying humanitarian aid, to continue on its journey to Aleppo. Scotland has set up an historic independence referendum. The Principality's leader has signed an agreement with Britain's Prime Minister, which finalises arrangements for a vote that could lead to the end of its three centuries-old union with England. Scotland's drive for sovereignty, led by its nationalist leader Alex Salmond, echoes separatist moves by other European regions, such as Catalonia and Flanders, which feel they could prosper as separate entities inside the European Union. The Pakistani schoolgirl who was shot in the head by the Taliban last week has arrived in the UK for further medical treatment. Pakistan's army says 14-year-old Malala Yousafzai needs prolonged treatment. She's been treated at a military hospital in Rawalpindi, but doctors say her progress over the next few days will be critical. The Taliban say they shot her because she opposed them and promoted secularism and Western thinking by encouraging girls to be educated. Two American economists, Alvin Roth and Lloyd Shapley, have won the 2012 Nobel Prize for Economics. The prize was given for their work on how to match different economic agents, such as students for schools or organ donors with patients. Indonesian officials have launched an investigation after a passenger jet landed at the wrong airport. The Sriwijaya Air jet had about 100 people on board when it took off on Saturday from Medan in northern Sumatra en route for Padang. But it landed at the Tabing Air Force Base, 12 kilometres from its destination. The pilot's been suspended. That's the latest Monocle 24 news.
Thank you, Bill. At 6 minutes past the hour here in London, as indeed it is everywhere except in those places like Afghanistan and South Australia, where it's 6 minutes past the half hour, or the completely ridiculous exceptions like Kathmandu, where it's now 6 minutes past three quarters past the hour or something. I think they just do it to annoy us. Anyway, you are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24. Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ja jokso.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Propojalavet. Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
After I'm into Monocle 24.
The hat at Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
24. 24. 24.
You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One in London with me, Andrew Muller. Well, one doubts that many bookmakers were taking bets, but for the record, yesterday's regional elections in Russia were a clean sweep for Vladimir Putin's United Russia Party. United Russia won all five gubernatorial races and all six legislative contests. Whether or not the low turnout was a cause or effect of United Russia's dominance, it was indeed impressively apathetic. In Primorsky, fewer than 8% of the electorate bothered to vote. Well, joining me in the studio now to discuss what this means for Putin and the people he insists on governing is Peter Van Dyke, Monocle's Moscow correspondent. Peter, first of all, the United Russia candidates for governor especially tended to poll in the mid-60s and up. Are these results even slightly surprising?
Well, not surprising to President Putin. He said that the result was not unexpected. I think that the governor race is probably not unexpected. Yes, many they did open up the gubernatorial elections to a degree, but they didn't let that many of the candidates who wanted to get in.
Of course, Putin scrapped regional, or at least elected regional governors during his first presidency.
Yes, in 2004, that's right. And after the protests in December, they brought back gubernatorial elections, direct elections. Between then and now, they've reappointed or replaced about 20 by presidential decree. And also, Putin made sure that this new law allowing gubernatorial elections did actually include some level of oversight by the authorities. So you can't just turn up and get on the ballot. And really, a lack of competition means that people don't do that well. The communists are still the strongest opposition in many regions, and their support has been flatlined between 15 and 20% for, you know, a decade or so. So Yeah, it's not an unexpected result for the governors.
Well, Putin talks, doubtless with a commendably straight face, about the results being not unexpected. But poor though the turnout was, do you think these elections, or do you get the sense that these elections were at least relatively honest?
That's not certainly the reports that are coming through from monitors. They're talking about administrative pressures. They're talking about candidates not being able to campaign in a totally free environment. That, in particular, for someone like Yevgenia Chirikova in the Moscow suburb of Khimki, where she's been a protest leader against a highway that's due to go through some protected forest. She's been a very visible member of the protest movement in Moscow. She was running for mayor, polled about 18%. The semi-incumbent temporary mayor got about 48%. And they have alleged a lot of violations in the campaign and again now in the actual election. So there have been, the police said that there have been something like 1,200 violations registered with them. The Electoral Commissioner, I think, put the figure in several dozens. So, you know, there are differing views, but certainly the opposition, as usual and as you would expect, say there were lots of violations. So the impression is probably not fair, no.
Well, it was violations of this sort, or at least the allegations thereof, that brought out those large protests after the parliamentary elections last December. And to protest in Russia in December, you've really got to be pretty upset. Do you anticipate there being any kind of repeat of that in these slightly better weather?
No.
Why not? I mean, do you think there's any connection there between the sort of much ballyhooed trial of Pussy Riot in Moscow? Might that have been intended as a shot across the bows of potential dissenters?
Well, I think that this shows the problem facing the opposition, which is that you can only turn up and protest for so long when nothing actually changes. And it's clear that really things aren't changing. And the challenge is for the opposition, you know, there was a lot of violations documented by the opposition in December and again in March in the presidential elections. And the authorities just say, no, actually, it was perfectly fair. So how can the opposition go from them saying here are violations and then presenting what they say as evidence and have the authorities say no, these aren't violations, everything was fine, because until you have, as Chirikova said, until you have a free and fair election, you really don't have a chance. And that was her complaint. And funnily enough, this was a complaint that Yevgeny Primakov had in the year 2000 when he was seen as a challenger to Putin in his first presidential election. He said, democracy in Russia is not fair at the moment, and so I'm not going to run for president. And,
do you think that's the reason as well for the low turnout, that Russians just don't take this seriously?
I think in any election where you feel your vote doesn't matter, you're less likely to turn out. I mean, you know, we see that in any election in any country.
Is that what Russians of your acquaintance tell you?
Yes, and that was in part what drew the December protests. People on that occasion did turn out to vote and felt like their vote wasn't counted, and that drew the protests. And now they feel, oh, well, you know, our vote's not going to count. Doesn't matter. I mean, you see in Vladivostok, where you said in Primorye, the 8% turnout, incredibly low. But that has traditionally been, you know, it's a long, long way from Moscow, and they feel like that they really don't matter. And that is something that makes people stay away from the polls.
I mean, is there now any meaningful or serious opposition to United Russia anywhere in Russia?
There is, but there isn't within the structures of power. And this is
right.
the disconnect where, and that is why the turnout and people are generally apathetic. I mean, there is a slight contradiction here, though, because I was speaking to the head of Transparency International in Russia last week, and I put it to her that after the protests in December and then the election of Putin in March and now, that, you know, it's actually a little bit depressing that nothing's actually changed. And she, obviously, she's been working in this field for a long, long time and has to be an optimist by nature, I would guess. But she said, actually, we're feeling pretty positive because for the first time, people are coming to her office and saying, how can we help? So there is actually a new feeling of civic activism among Russians and you know, some Russians. And so it's a question of the opposition building on that and developing this activism among people who don't feel the apathy or who don't see, you know, President Putin on TV and see, yes, this is the answer. Because actually, it was interesting in what Putin said in saying, you know, these results weren't unexpected. He went on to thank voters for showing their support for the development of Russian statehood, which is quite a weird way to phrase that. And that is sort of part of the suggestion that it's somehow unpatriotic to vote against United Russia and against President Putin because you're voting against the development of Russian statehood.
A discouraging climate for dissenters in more ways than one in Russia. Peter Van Dyke, Monocle's man in Moscow, who's visiting us in London this week. Thank you for joining us. It's 16 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House.
Wake up in Asia or sip a nightcap in Europe to the Monocle Daily, with 2 hours of analysis and reports on current affairs, culture and business. Hear from experts, authors and editors of far-flung newspapers, as well as our own correspondents, every weekday at 2200 hours London time.
If you like Subways, not Subway sandwiches, if you want to know what makes a metropolis thrive or take a dive, and if you prefer the concrete jungle to the muddy field, then you need The Urbanist. Join me, Andrew Tuck, as we explore the urban landscape by tram, subway and taxi to meet the people out to make urban life even better. The latest episode of The Urbanist is all about tourism. We're going to find out what makes a city work for a tourist and one with an urbanist bent. We're going to meet Jeremy Hildreth, who's going to tell us about ad campaigns for cities, and Tom Burgess-Watson's going to tell us what it's like to live with the Eiffel Tower in your back garden.
I drive past this structure every day at least once, sometimes several times in one day. And the only time I really take note of its presence is when the Tour Eiffel does its electric light shimmy at night.
That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. SoftBank, the Japanese mobile operator, will spend $21.1 billion for up to 70% of Sprint, the third biggest carrier in the US. Between them, the two companies will have 96 million customers on both sides of the Pacific. So far, at least, the deal is not causing markets, analysts and ratings agencies to darken the skies with ecstatically flung hats. SoftBank shares are down by a fifth, and Moody's is contemplating downgrading their ratings. Joining me now to wonder whether SoftBank will outsmart the Jeremiahs is Roger Entner, analyst and founder of Recon Analytics. Roger, what's in this deal for SoftBank? What are they getting for their 20-odd billion?
Well, they're getting a 70% stake in a vastly undervalued company. The value of Sprint's spectrum alone is way greater than the 20 billion that the company is valued at right now. On top of it, you know, SoftBank has managed to win against two significantly larger competitors in Japan, and hopefully they can teach Sprint to do the same thing here in the U.S. And that's what this deal is based upon.
So these rating agencies and other observers who have taken the view that SoftBank might have bitten off more than they can chew, you don't think they have a point?
Well, the key here is really execution. If SoftBank and Sprint are executing well, I don't think they have bitten off more than they can chew. Now, if they're not executing well, you know, this can turn ugly quite quickly.
Well, SoftBank shares, on the subject of things turning ugly, SoftBank shares dropped 8% today, and they're down by a fifth since this deal was first mooted. What does that tell us?
Well, that tells us that the shareholders are concerned about the short-term outlook. Undoubtedly, Sprint needs other people's money, and here it is getting it from SoftBank, and the shareholders are concerned that the payoff in the end is not there. But when results are coming in and the company is turning around, I think the share price will go up again. And Sprint's short-term problem or Sprint's problems are basically in its Nextel division. And that division is being closed down in the next 2 to 3 years. Sprint brand division is growing quite nicely already.
Well, one component of this deal, of course, is that this infusion of cash from SoftBank will enable Sprint in turn to buy out its peers in the United States. Who might some of Sprint's targets be?
Well, I think the biggest target would be Clearwire, of which they already own half. And Clearwire sits on more than 150 megahertz on average per market. In some markets, more than 200. That's four to five times what any competitor has. And that would be the logical next acquisition or integration project. Then you have also Leap Wireless or Entelos as potential targets.
I mean, how is this deal likely to play with U.S. consumers? Do you think American customers really care ultimately who owns their mobile networks? Is there any concern of any sort of backlash if people feel like the company's not an American company anymore?
I don't think that there's any backlash at all. Americans are quite oblivious to who owns, what carrier, TracFone, which is the fifth largest operator, is owned by a Mexican, Carlos Slim, and they're buying, Mexican services as well. And so, or T-Mobile is, owned by Deutsche Telekom, and that has never been a problem. So, I think those days of, where you had flags and picket lines, buy American, are long over.
I mean, what do you anticipate will be SoftBank's first move once the acquisition goes through? What will change about Sprint?
Well, I think they will bring some particular Japanese innovations to the market. For example, what is commonplace in Japan is that the longer you are with a Japanese carrier, the more your bill goes down, because they give you a reward for loyalty. That would be something that's very easy to integrate and to launch. I think where they both can help each other is with their LTE networks. SoftBank both has a TD-LTE, what Clearwire is using, and an FD-LTE, what Sprint is using. I'm sorry for the horrible acronyms, but it's like these two flavors of LTE where consumers are oblivious and don't care about either and don't have to care about. But it's a technical detail, and SoftBank can help there greatly.
Roger Entner of Recon Analytics, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monaco 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se om Monaco 24.
Sunday, Efrognewit, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monaco 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
And it's time now to head to New York to find out from Monocle's bureau chief, Aisha Spears, what's been making the news where she is over the weekend. Good evening, Aisha.
Good afternoon from me, Andrew. How are you?
I'm all right. 5 hours ahead of you, clearly, but I'm fine. First of all, I've been reading some of the stories that you've alerted us to, and I'm a bit baffled by residents of the Lower East Side getting upset that people are going to bars near where they live. This strikes me as a bit like moving to New York and then complaining that the taxis are yellow.
Indeed. Well, I mean, one of the things about living in Manhattan that you have to swallow is the fact that noise is everywhere, as are clubs and bars and restaurants. And I think noise complaints are the number one complaints that 311, the city kind of complaints agency, non-emergency number, gets. The Lower East Side is a particularly bad neighbourhood for that. There are a lot of clubs, a lot of bars, a lot of restaurants. And it seems that some residents have decided that now, for some reason, is the time to get together and form some sort of group to pressurise the community board to stop giving liquor licences to new bars and new restaurants in the neighbourhood. It is a particularly noisy area. I wouldn't choose to live there, but it's definitely one which seems to, you know, attracts a lot of business to the neighbourhood. The Lower East Side is a destination for out-of-towners to go and spend money in the city. So I wonder how far that will go with the state liquor licence people.
Is this one of those things that's part of the process of gentrification, that people sort of start moving to a place because they like the idea of living in an edgy neighbourhood, and then they realise that living in an edgy neighbourhood also means you're living in quite a noisy and disorderly one, and then start complaining that the edgy neighbourhood they move to is too edgy?
Indeed, and I think you can see that across many parts of downtown Manhattan. I think the Meatpacking District is probably the worst offender there. You've got clubs there which go through the daytime, the kind of club that you would probably see in Ibiza rather than in the middle of New York. You have daytime clubs, you have nighttime clubs. There's always something going on. It's full of out-of-towners. And there's a lot of restaurants and bars that cater to those people coming in. And alongside that, you've got places like Soho House. You've got quite nice hotels. You've got a lot of very nice housing. And people there are trying to work out how to make that sustainable. The Lower East Side's slightly less upmarket place to live, and it is I'm sure a lot of people who have moved there in order to be able to go out and go to these bars. I guess they just don't like the fact that it's people who aren't locals who are going to these bars. The website for this advocacy group has pictures of people who are having fun in the neighborhood, and then a big slogan saying these people aren't from the neighborhood. So I think it's more a case of this is my turf, not yours.
Well, I understand another attempt to ameliorate the worst behaviour of New Yorkers isn't going terrifically well. This is the counterintuitive idea to clean up the underground by removing the rubbish bins.
Indeed, we're painting a very disgusting picture of New York right now.
When I say underground, I mean subway. Well, New York is it's
pretty dirty.
It is not a city in which one would choose to eat one's lunch off the footpath.
No, absolutely not. I'm not sure I'd want to do that in many cities. But yes, the MTA, I think we spoke about this in the summer. They announced this program where they would remove the garbage bins from some stations, saying that this will deter people from bringing garbage into the stations. Instead, they will dispose of it outside of the stations before they get on the subway. This clearly has not worked. A lot of people are thinking it wouldn't work in the first place, and now you can go into certain stations where this has been enacted, and you see people are cramming their rubbish into nooks and crannies in the floor and the walls, or they're just putting it on the tracks themselves. And so I think that's been a clear failure for the MTA, who are also facing a little bit of bad press at the moment because they've announced that they're certainly going to be raising fares quite considerably too.
Manhattan's rat population, doubtless extraordinarily grateful. The presidential campaign getting towards its final weeks now, and Romney, I understand, or Romney's people at least, or people acting on his behalf, are trying to besmirch the good reputation of the vice president.
Good old Joe Biden. Yes, so of course, the vice presidential debate, which happened on Tuesday this week, caused a lot of stir. Predominantly because Biden managed to giggle and laugh at a number of things that Paul Ryan was trying to say.
It's a reasonable response to some of Paul Ryan's fiscal policies.
It's a very reasonable response. And I think also, you know, as a debate tactic, I'm not sure necessarily that it was a bad thing. He engaged the public in a way that Obama wasn't able to. So people who aren't immediately critical of Biden, I think, saw it as quite a good thing. And it did help the poll numbers, despite the fact that Romney's looking better still since the first presidential debate. But he was laughing a lot. And so yesterday, the Romney campaign launched their first video playing on this, their first campaign ad, with pictures of a split screen of Biden giggling and Ryan, just segments of what he was saying, making him sound like he was making a good point. So it kind of made Joe Biden look like a giggling school child. But I'm sure we'll be seeing this. There's two more debates to go. We'll be seeing a lot of this kind of stuff.
And finally, this week's story, which has upset people who enjoy getting upset about things, is that the Barclays Center accused of having a racist metal detector policy, on the grounds that they had if I've got this right, they had metal detectors installed for the Jay-Z shows, but not so much for the Barbara Streisand ones.
Indeed, I feel like there could almost be an entire series of what's going on at the Barclays Center, what controversy is happening there, because it's such a huge urban planning mission for New York. So the Barclays Center, which opened recently, a big sports and show space had a Jay-Z concert where there were metal detectors for everyone going in, and then Barbara Streisand played a few days later and there were no metal detectors going in. So people are saying, is this some sort of racially motivated decision on the part of the owners, but which would seem silly because Jay-Z is involved in the business of the basketball team that play at the Barclays Center, so one would assume not. But it's definitely their first bit of pretty bad press that I'm sure there'll be more to come.
Aisha Spears in New York, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. In the next half hour of the programme, Hugo MacDonald will be talking to the co-curator of the inaugural Istanbul Design Biennial, and Monocle's senior editorial staff will weigh in from around the world with their favourite moments of Monocle 24 nearly 1 year in.
I think that's been one of the most extraordinary things over the years. It's just not the recognition that comes with it, but the feeling that you're growing something that feels very inclusive, that people feel incredibly invested in.
But first, here's Bill Bingham with the news headlines.
The former captain of the capsized cruise ship Costa Concordia has appeared in court at a pre-trial hearing into January's disaster. Legal teams and experts have begun to try to reconstruct the accident in a series of pre-trial hearings attended by Francesco Schettino. The court will decide if he should face a full trial, which could take place next year. Israel has welcomed the news that European Union governments have agreed further sanctions against Iran's banking, shipping and industrial sectors. The move's designed to increase financial pressure on Tehran to enter serious negotiations on its nuclear programme. EU foreign ministers are concerned Israel may attack Iranian atomic installations if a combination of sanctions and diplomacy doesn't produce a peaceful solution. The number of Syrian refugees housed in camps in southern Turkey has gone into six figures. The Turkish Disaster Management Agency, AFAD, say 100,000 is a level beyond which Ankara had previously said it could accommodate. Air Armenia are denying that Turkey forced their aeroplane to land in the eastern Turkish city of Erzurum. The airline's director, Arsen Avet Isyan, explained it was a scheduled landing on the route from the Armenian capital Yerevan to Aleppo in Syria. Turkey gave the flight an all clear and allowed the Armenian plane, which was carrying humanitarian aid, to continue on its journey to Aleppo. Scotland has set up an historic independence referendum. The Principality's leader has signed an agreement with Britain's Prime Minister, which finalises arrangements for a vote that could lead to the end of its three-centuries-old union with England. The Pakistani schoolgirl who was shot in the head by the Taliban last week has arrived in the UK for further medical treatment. Pakistan's army says 14-year-old Malala Yousafzai needs prolonged treatment. She's been treated at a military hospital in Rawalpindi, but doctors say her progress over the next few days will be critical. And two American economists, Alvin Roth and Lloyd Shapley, have won the 2012 Nobel Prize for Economics. The prize was given for their work on how to match different economic agents, such as students for schools or organ donors with patients. That's the latest Monocle 24 news at the bottom of the hour.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24, live from London. Over the weekend, Istanbul became the latest city of around 80 around the world at last count to stage its own design event. The city has been biding its time wisely, however. Rather than simply provide a series of venues for furniture industry grandees to showcase their wares, the Istanbul Design Biennial is more a forum for discussion, debate and general digestion of issues pertaining to design. Monocle's design editor Hugo MacDonald spoke earlier to Joseph Greimer, editor of Domus and co-curator of the Biennial. Hugo began by asking why the need for yet another design event.
Well, it's true, there are a lot and more design events on the calendar around the world. However, I think that the Istanbul Design Biennale has succeeded in carving out a niche that is actually surprisingly underpopulated, in the sense that we have all sorts of Salone del Mobile, furniture fair clones here and there. We have lots of design weeks. There's all sorts of stuff in the league of kind of presenting new products to the market. But what is actually surprisingly absent, even today, is platforms for the interrogation of designs, kind of a more critical approach to the presentation of design. So I think that the biennial as a format is extremely interesting in this regard. I mean, there's only one or two others, perhaps the Guangzhou Biennale of Design, there's Experimenta in Lisbon and maybe a couple of others, but there aren't actually that many platforms for a more kind of critical approach to design exhibitions.
So this is more about discussion, raising awareness, raising issues, rather than a showcase of sort of what is made in Turkey, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's the way it's positioned itself, of course, is in the legacy of the Biennial of Contemporary Art in Istanbul, which is enormously respected within the art world. It's one of them, probably the most important art biennials in the world. And it's, of course, regarded as an extremely serious event in which kind of critical positions in artistic practice are regularly presented and discussed.
So it's a global gathering of people for a series of talks and discussions and things, but does it have any sort of lasting impact on Istanbul or sort of Turkey itself, do you think?
Well, I hope so. I mean, the exhibition that I curated there, which is called Adhocracy, brings in a lot of experimental designers from all over the world, people who are not simply presenting objects, but to actually presenting processes and almost a kind of performative aspect. To be able to, obviously they couldn't stick around for the whole 2 months of the duration of the exhibition, so we were compelled to find ways for them to engage with the local reality, to find local collaborators who would be able to continue their work even in their absence. And I think that this is actually one of the most interesting and most important parts of the exhibition and of the biennial, is the kind of the knowledge that they'll leave behind, the kind of the shared experience of having run these projects. And that one of the things that the biennial has the potential to do is to spark off a new tradition, a new kind of understanding of what design is in the local reality. And I think that's what we're really hoping that it'll do there in Istanbul.
You mentioned your exhibition there that you curated, Adhocracy. What exactly does that mean?
The title is a bit of a provocation in a way. It's attempting to tackle a very contemporary question, which is that of the how production is changing. There's a lot of talk at the moment about the idea of the third industrial revolution, about how manufacturing is being completely transformed by new technologies. And we wanted to look at that. We wanted to almost take that as a starting point rather than a point of arrival, and to actually look at what the potential effects are in a much broader realm. So what the kind of political and social implications of this are, what it means for the kind of productive mechanisms that are in place today for industry, for logistics, for architecture, for urbanism. But most of all, we wanted to really look at the idea of something that goes well beyond the realm of technology, which is a kind of a sea change in the way we understand the relationship between producers, designers, producers, and consumers, this kind of triangle that has typically been organized according to a pretty sort of hierarchical top-down model in which the designer can send something over to a manufacturer who produces it, and then that's kind of put on the market, and the consumer is left to this kind of a quite passive role of consumption. We think that today, as a consequence of the empowerment of individuals, of end users, one very simple, most obvious example is kind of social networks that have completely transformed our understanding of media. This sort of culture of participation, of adaptation, has really seeped into every aspect of life. And that has enormous consequences on design, and it's something that design is actually beginning to embrace seriously for the first time. So Adhocracy is an attempt to kind of frame an alternative model of organization from that of bureaucracy, which was the typical model of organization of the 20th century. And whereas Adhocracy, this kind of adaptive model, this much more fluid model, is what we perceive as the organizing structure of the 21st century.
And this is an issue that you say is being discussed around the world at the moment, the sort of advent of perhaps a third industrial revolution. But is there a particular relevance to sort of Adhocracy being launched at the Istanbul Design Biennial for the first time? And how do people sort of in Istanbul respond to this, rather than just people outside going to Istanbul to talk about it and then leaving again?
I think that it wasn't a coincidence that this was the thing that we chose to discuss in Istanbul, because as anybody who's been to Istanbul knows, Istanbul is a city that's absolutely permeated, completely saturated by the spaces of production, by people doing things and making things. It's something that's completely, absolutely integrated into the urban fabric. And this is something that often is kind of considered, until very recently, was really considered kind of a model of the past, the artisan working in his craft shop. Actually, what we posited with this exhibition is that that is actually not the past, but model of the future, that there is the possibility that manufacturing is going to return to our city centres. And this is something we'd looked at already in an exhibition organised with Domus at the Salon of Immobile, the theme of manufacturing's return to Europe, to even to city centres, perhaps thanks to the advent of new technologies that are able to produce not necessarily millions of objects, but just a few. So the equivalent of the local print shop in terms of manufacturing. And that is something that, of course, is even more relevant in a city like Istanbul. And so therefore, the part of our ambition with this exhibition was to actually encourage Istanbul to reevaluate itself, to also value this knowledge about how to make things is actually one of the greatest wealths of this society.
And that was Hugo MacDonald talking to Joseph Greimer, editor of Domus and co-curator of the inaugural Istanbul Design Biennial, which is running until December the 12th. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Subscribe to Monocle and you'll receive 10 hefty issues and our two seasonal newspapers delivered anywhere in the world. You'll also receive our special edition canvas tote bag and sometimes even invitations to special events in our key markets. With a variety of subscription options, Monocle is available monthly from £45, and you can also order our special gift package for friends and clients who want to keep an eye on the world. Subscribe today at monocle.com or pop into our shops in Tokyo, Hong Kong, London and New York.
And welcome back to Midori House. The time is 18:41 here in London. The new print issue of Monocle is on newsstands now, or now about. It sounds like this. It's issue 58. It focuses on health, introducing the people and the ideas which will hopefully help us all live longer and better. And joining me now to talk me through it is Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield.
Issue 58?
It is 58 issues.
Wow. I remember issue one.
So do I.
Anyway, let's not talk about that now. Yes, it's all about health. Health of Nations, time for your global checkup. And so what we've done with this issue is looked at sort of some of the politics of health. We've looked at sort of great healthcare models. We've looked at a bit of the culture of health as well. There's a lovely report about The Lancet in the culture section. There's one of, I think, our finest expos ever, which is lots of Japanese people doing exercises in their offices. Has to be seen, really, to be believed.
That this really is a none more Monocle photo spread, isn't it?
It is. It's very good. But I will, all the other editors will be in this week to sort of tell you a little bit about their sections. But let me tell you a little bit about the front parts. We've got a big health report. And what we've tried to do is be a little bit unusual with it. So while, yes, we've looked at sort of who has the best nurses, who has the best doctors, the best hospitals, so on, we've also asked questions like, where's the best city in the world to get your head checked?
And it turns out, this is something I didn't know that I woke up when I woke up this morning, Montevideo has the largest number of trained psychologists in the world.
Indeed, yes, it does indeed. And a lovely spread of photos of nine of those psychologists and psychoanalysts in their, what do you call them? I was going to say offices, but that doesn't quite describe it.
I was going to say chairs, which I'm guessing isn't the word you were grasping for either.
But you know what I mean.
Yes.
In the place where they do their work. And it was really fascinating actually doing this, editing this section, because it was, you had some really interesting stories about, the Western clinics and hospitals that were going out to the Gulf and setting up there. So, for example, Moorfields Eye Hospital, which is just set up in Dubai. There's others that have set up in Kuwait as well. And then we did a lovely piece as well about the mayor of Oklahoma.
Who's been a reasonably frequent guest on Monocle 24.
Yes.
We've spoken to him about various subjects. He seems like an awfully nice chap.
He is indeed, and he basically realised he was a little bit tubby, and so were many of his citizens, so he decided to not only go on a diet himself, but put the city on a diet, and collectively they lost £1 million.
That's in a good way. That's
yes.
Pounds as in...
Pounds, fat, LBS.
Not the United Kingdom currency. Yeah, Mayor Mick Cornett of Oklahoma, who... I remember we did an interview on the Daily once about something, by the end of which he'd almost persuaded me to buy property there.
There we are. He's obviously a persuasive kind of guy, making you buy property and making Oklahomans lose weight. So that's sort of a little overview of the front bits of the issue. Now, of course, not only are we going to be talking about this all this week, the issue, but we're going to be talking about our first birthday, aren't we?
We are. We have a thing on that coming up. But throughout the year, one of the things we have been doing is having musicians come in here and play.
Yes.
And you have a particular favourite moment from the Midori House session.
Yes. Each Ed who comes in this week is going to choose their favourite track from Midori House session. And there were several that I could have chosen. I was thinking about Jana Factory, who are wonderful, three very sort of tall Amazonian Danish women playing guitars. But I've gone for James Yorkston, who was brilliant and beautiful. And this is a short blues.
Lately, I find I struggle to keep myself out of the blue. That a dear old friend had passed, taken by the same thing that has its claws in you. But I remember times when we had nothing but the sun upon us. I remember days when we felt nothing but the sun upon us. Lately, I find I struggle to kid myself out of the blues. And I hear as she sang in her last days, and she sent all her love and love this way. But I remember times when we had nothing but the sun upon us. I remember days when we felt nothing but the sun upon us. I remember days when we knew nothing but the sun upon us.
It's James Yorkston with a short blues, Steve Bloomfield's choice of the best of the first year's Midori House sessions. And you are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. And this Wednesday, as we were just discussing, we'll mark 1 year of Monocle 24 Radio. That's 8,784 hours of broadcasting. And yes, I have allowed for the leap year. To mark the occasion, Monocle's foreign editor and regular radio presenter, Steve Bloomfield, who you just heard from, caught up with our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, in New York, and our editor, Andrew Tuck, who's in Dubai at the moment, to reminisce about a few of their favourite moments of the last 12 months.
So almost 1 year ago to the day, we were all sat round this table here in Studio One at 6 a.m. ready to do the very first Globalist. 1 year on, Tyler, how do you think it's going so far?
I think it's going pretty good. The fact that I'm in our New York bureau right now speaking on an ISDN line, I think is a huge step for technology. Men can sort of, jump from, 128,000 feet and, speed towards Earth. I think this is a much bigger achievement.
Sadly, no ISDN yet to Dubai, but Andrew, you're working on that, aren't you?
No, but it's good to be down here and talking to lots of people about what we're doing on Monocle 24 and just seeing how much people get it. It's been incredible how the word of radio has kind of really helped Monocle spread its name around the world.
I was going to say, Steve, one of the best point, or certainly sort of piece of evidence that I have so far, I was in Chicago a couple of days ago and was running around having a bit of a weekend shop in a very nice men's store, and I was asking for a couple of jumpers, and as I was walking upstairs, the gentleman said, he goes, have you heard of Monocle 24? And I sort of looked at him, I thought, now is he winding me up? And I said, yeah, I said, I have. And he said, you really sound like Tyler Brulé. And I said that's very kind of you. And then I sort of, you know, proceeded to the cash. He goes, you wouldn't be him, would you? And I thought, well, it's amazing that we're even sort of penetrating the world of retail in Chicago, which is great news.
And Steve, I think that's what's interesting about that is, you know, that what's fascinating is a print brand. You know how your message goes out. We've done it for 5 years. People read us on page, and we have a certain voice and a certain tone. And we're certainly delivering something very similar in print. But there is something very interesting about people literally hearing your voices. I think it's a very welcoming medium. And it's fed back into the print. So I think that's been one of the most extraordinary things over the years. It's just not the recognition that comes with it, but the feeling that you're growing something that feels very inclusive, that people feel incredibly invested in. Because it's with them all day. They're sitting in their office, and you're talking to them, you're informing them, you're bringing them music from around the world. And I think that makes a print brand suddenly very intimate.
And Tyler, let's talk about that print brand. I mean, how do you feel that the radio has helped to feed into what we do with the magazine? How have the two worked so well together?
Well, I think there are two interesting things that have happened. And the first one has to be just the metabolism and the tempo. And I know we talk a lot about it in the office, but how we've gone from being a 10 times a year magazine to then 12 times with the addition of course, our newspaper editions. But then suddenly you move into an environment where it never stops. It's, as we found, it's an incredibly hungry beast, but it's actually a very friendly beast to feed at the end of the day. And you know, I certainly from an editorial point of view, I think we almost had to construct, I'm not sure if it's two or three different hemispheres in our brains where you figure out what's going to be long form, what's going to really work and make sense in print, and you know, how do we want to save that. But at the same time, I think you're always thinking, how can we extract stories, but not to milk them, but there's an immediacy. And I think, you know, a good example, you know, just off the back of the General Assembly, how you did a number of things in New York, Steve, but then there's some things that we do want to hold back. And then we have, I think, a very clever and intelligent way of then promoting those pieces in a longer form format and driving people to the magazine. So I think from those two areas, it's been a great discipline. I don't want to say it's a learning curve. It's just been a wonderful education in using this medium in an effective way.
And Andrew, it's been interesting sort of developing The Office from a monthly magazine into also a daily news machine as well. Well, in fact, an hourly news machine.
Yeah, and I think that you certainly, right, by catching up with both me and Tyler on the road today, and that's one of the interesting things is that you're never off these days. Wherever you are in the world, you check in, and it's great to be here. You know, we did it with you earlier on today, Steve. We talked about what was happening here in the UAE and up in Qatar. And that's great that suddenly the things you're seeing, the stories you're reporting on, the people you're meeting, that becomes very immediate. And I think that turning us into a news machine, it's taken effort, but it's the buzz on our editorial floor now is so interesting because, you know, a year ago, yes, of course it was busy, but it had the cycle of a magazine going to bed, and the final week would be incredibly hectic, and the other weeks would have a bit more of a kind of even pace then. And now, you know, there's a daily rhythm like that. Every time we get near to one of the live shows, you feel that amazing energy in the office as people are running back and forth, as stories are coming together, as we're contacting our correspondents around the world.
Tyler, let's talk about some personal highlights since we've had almost 365 days so far. What stands out for you in particular?
It's quite a catalogue. In one way, it all blurs together in this incredible stream because that's what it is. But of course, you know, launches are always launches. But I would say, you know, I can still, you know, think back to, you know, all of us assembled, you know, around Studio One where you are at the moment, and just, you know, watching that clock countdown and knowing that there were so many instances, you know, when this thing really felt like it was going to teeter off the air. but then, you know, every single day as it went, you know, as it, you know, clipped along, of course, it improved and the sound, you know, sharpened quite literally. But I think a couple of things that stand out for me. And maybe just working our web back, it was great having someone like Martha Stewart in our office, someone who I've always respected as just an incredible media entrepreneur, someone who's developed, you know, such a unique brand. I think one of the very early pioneers who moved from print, who went into television, who went on to series with radio, and you know, she created Martha Stewart Omni Media. It was great that she felt that, you know, that she wanted to come to Midori House and in part see what we're doing, but also tell her story. And it was amazing just the amount of emails I received over the weekend. You know, she appeared on the stack. We also, you know, used her in some of our daily programs as well, but just everyone said, it was just such a great interview that, you know, people would sort of, you know, rarely hear, you know, Martha maybe speak. And perhaps about politics and as much as should we be talking about media as well. So I think, to me, what stands out are just the great sort of breadth of talent. You know, we mentioned your piece that you did, Steve, when you sat around at the Brazilian embassy to the UN here in New York, and you had Carl Bild there. I think it was one of the outstanding things was just being able to chase Carl Bild around London and then have him turn our reception room into his own private meeting space because he was so comfortable in that environment. Having Kylie Minogue come on to sing jingles for us, and I think also all of the great Olympic work that everyone did this summer. I think just being able to take all of our programming out on the road. Those things are outstanding. But I think from a personnel point of view, the one thing that really stands out for me, I think most importantly, is that we brought in a series of individuals who, in many ways, they came into a print environment that was moving into radio. They didn't know a lot about the craft of actually pulling stories together, doing lineups, running live programs. And if I look at just this extraordinary wealth of talent that came in at an intern researcher level, and people have moved up to being associate producers and producers within a year and have this wealth of talent. That's another thing. It's not content in terms of necessarily a tangible thing that people listen to, yet at the same time it is, because we wouldn't have the sound without those individuals.
Andrew, before we come to you, let's play a little bit of Martha and a little bit of Kylie.
And what about public broadcasting in America?
Oh, that's my morning show in the car.
Right.
That's what I listen to in the car on the radio. And I am a news junkie. I read three newspapers while I'm listening to NPR radio. So, and I have to know what's going on.
It's been almost a year since you've been in Studio 2.
It's been far too long.
I know, very, very.
I am back in the bosom of Monocle Studios.
That was Martha Stewart and Kylie Minogue as well. Andrew, your personal highlights from the first year?
Well, I feel as Tyler's slightly taken the high road there.
He said all of them, really, hasn't he?
Yeah, he has. Maybe I should go a little bit more and point out that there have been fun moments as well, and many fun moments, and many of them actually including when I think all three of us have been on air. I think I'm the only person to have had a dog as a guest.
So that's true, yes.
We could have the dog on if we can find a clip of the dog who came on and sat on my lap. It's the only guest who insisted on sitting on my lap throughout the whole show.
So far.
You've asked others, but they've said no.
I've requested it many times, but they've said no. But I agree with Tyler. I think what's also been amazing is being out on the road. And we did a couple of amazing series from Switzerland. I know there was a great set of shows from Milan. And recently, Marcus and Adrian Craddock and me went up to Helsinki, and we did Midori House from there. And another good clip is just meeting, I think, the U.S. ambassador, and there's a dog theme here, the U.S. ambassador to Helsinki, a man who was a former bodybuilder who's done huge things for diplomacy between the U.S. and Helsinki, but another man who turned up with a giant dog as a guest.
Well, let's hear a little bit of that.
I'm smiling because there's a giant dog staring at me from the end of the table, who looks very gorgeous. And we have a very special edition of Midori House, Dogs and All, coming to you live from the Finnish Broadcasting Company studios in Helsinki.
Andrew, I've never seen you this excited. It's the dog.
It is the dog, I'm afraid.
That was Andrew's Finnish show. Andrew, Tyler, thank you both very much for your memories 1 year on. I think the only fitting way really to end this is by playing a little bit
Happy Birthday. We have to play Happy Birthday.
Well, we could play Happy Birthday. I was going to say we could play a little bit from that first show. Would you rather
idea.
We played Happy Birthday or a bit? No, let's do the first show. Tyler Brûlé in New York, thank you very much. And Andrew Tuck in Dubai.
Good morning from Midori House here in London, and welcome to this first edition of The Globalist here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brûlé, Andrew Tuck and Steve Bloomfield.
Ahead on the programme, we'll be talking to Sweden's Foreign Minister Carl Bildt about why...
1 year later, that's all we have time for. Thanks to our producer Hannah Jenkins, our researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco and our studio manager Sam Impey. I'll be back with Tamsin Smith for The Daily at 2200. That's in about 3 hours. But for now, thanks for listening. Good evening.